And I like to get a little bit of an idea of what, where your interest may lie. So I wonder if you could let me know by a show of hands, how many people in the room have some type of clinical background, a physician, a nurse, PA? Hello, welcome. So my background is in nursing as well, so as well as some of you in medicine. And who in the room would be involved in health policy or regulatory efforts? Yes, very good. And here we are at APHA, so people involved in public health and in a more traditional kind of way. Fantastic. That's, you know, what we would expect. And I know I see a couple researchers in the room. Anybody working on research as well? Great. So a really nice mix, a very multidisciplinary group, which I really love. So I wanted to let you know that part of my role at the Collaborative on Health and the Environment is to help bring together a multidisciplinary group from varied backgrounds, as you're describing, and to bring us together in a conversation in a working group. So one of the ways that we go ahead and work on projects is to look at the application of environmental health science into clinical practice. So the latter part of my presentation does focus on clinical practice. I think in the interest of time, I will be moving through that rather quickly, but the slides, of course, are available online. And I hope that those of you who are not involved in clinical practice may find this information interesting and maybe useful to share with colleagues who are in clinical work. So we do have several goals, of course, for this conversation. I wanted to give you a little bit of a background in infertility. What are some of the environmental contributors to infertility? And then spend a few minutes talking about exposures during pregnancy, because certainly, you know, the topic for today's conversation is healthy aging across the lifespan, and how does that begin in the womb with prenatal exposures, because truly it does. And then, as I said, towards the end, I have some more information on some environmental health screening tools that have been developed more recently, and there's an ever-growing body of information online. You know, patients can look that type of information up for themselves, but certainly I hope that we, as people involved in public health and healthcare and other efforts, are giving the patients reliable information through our practices as well. So starting out talking about infertility, the data that's available, first there's been dozens upon dozens of studies over the last few decades about chemicals in our environment, other factors in our environment, like stress, like the built environment, like the heavy metals and other contaminants that are not artificial chemicals. And this data that's presented here is really just a snapshot of trends in male fertility, looking at the indicator of the sperm count over several decades. So this was really a landmark study published by Carlson et al. It is a few years old at this point, but it was really groundbreaking at the time because it presented some historic data collected over a wide range from many countries, European countries and the U.S., and it looked at the data on sperm concentration or sperm counts that were collected in the far past at this point, in the 1940s, where the concentration of male sperm counts was more along the lines of 120 million, and then over time it declined to almost half of that concentration. So this was really felt to be indicative of some serious environmental problems that have happened in our world over that 50-year lifespan. So whether this looks at, you know, the historic trend, and there are many, many other studies that look at what those contaminants might be. So there has been links between pesticides, heavy metals, phthalates, all types of different substances that are contaminants of our food, our water, our air. And so at this point, because we're giving an overview, I won't be presenting a large amount of that data, but I would let you know that there is a handout with a long list of those types of studies in the back if you'd like more information. So I just wanted to pick out one that was, I thought, a particularly good example because it is a review of many different types of pesticides over a 15-year period. So you can see that Perry and his colleagues in 2008 reviewed data on pyrethroids, OPs, a variety of different pesticides, and did find that the majority of studies on pesticides and sperm indicators, including concentration, but also DNA damage in the sperm and some abnormalities in the sperm morphology, as I described there at the end. The majority of studies did support that pesticides are damaging male sperm. And then when you go to look at the female counterpart, the database is not quite as robust, but certainly this review by Mandula and her colleagues in 2008 also found that there was really strong evidence to support that there are a variety of environmental contaminants, especially lead, can impact female fertility. And the other compounds that the authors felt were especially concerning were pesticides and POP. This is another review of female reproductive disorders done by Kane and his colleagues in 2008. And they looked not just at one type of female fertility issue, but really a wide range of female fertility problems, including issues with the ovary and ovulation, issues with the uterus, and then eventually, you know, longer term in the women's lifespan, what was the likelihood of breast cancer, and then in the shorter term, looking at duration of lactation. And the authors found that really exposure to endocrine disrupting compounds had a significant effect on all these indicators as well. So I would just like to point out that my esteemed colleague Ted Settler did do a review in 2011 that was really exhaustive and covered a lot of the data that has been generated over the last couple decades, and that's available on the Collaborative on the Health and Environments website. Take a little sip, and then I'm going to tell you a little story, moving away from the fertility issues. So, since I'm assuming that many of you in the room have an established interest in environmental health, many of you may have already heard the story, but for those of you who haven't, I would love to tell you about a biomonitoring study that was done by the Environmental Working Group. It was done a few years ago at this point, but it was really widely publicized and a nice snapshot into a rather random sample of Americans looking at what substances are found in their blood. And you can see, I'm not going to go through the whole table, but you can see, although it's a very small sample of just 10 Americans, those people did have a wide variety of industrial chemicals present in their bloodstream, from pesticides to PFCs to mercury down there at the bottom, and the associated, you know, use of those chemicals is there on the left column. So if we look at sort of wide category of where these chemicals fall, we see that the pesticides are recurrent throughout this sample of Americans. So one might think that these people were farm workers or were people who somehow, you know, worked in a plant that manufactured pesticides. But this was not the case. And then as you look down under some of the naphthalenes are involved in industry and mechanical production, so you might think that they were factory workers, but in fact they were not. So I will just let you know that these people were in fact infants, and the examples that were given were from cord blood samples. So this is one of the first really striking cord blood studies that found, as Ted had mentioned, over 200 industrial chemicals in these infant cord blood samples. So, unfortunately, those chemicals that were identified are associated with a wide range of diseases in different epidemiological studies. As you can see, 180 of those chemicals are known to cause cancer in humans and also in animal studies. 217 are neurotoxicants. 208 of those chemicals can lead to birth defects. There is some overlap there because some of the chemicals cause more than one detrimental effect. So while this was a small sample and this was rather alarming information from my point of view, I'm sure from yours as well, these same types of cord blood studies have been done since that time, and some were done slightly before that time as well. So I wanted to point out a really a nice recent study of infant cord blood samples. So I'm hoping that you're aware that right here in San Francisco at UCSF, you have a program on reproductive health and the environment, and that's headed up by Tracy Woodruff and another a whole variety of excellent researchers. And they have several projects looking at both infant cord blood and also chemicals that have been found in pregnant women's blood samples. Tracy Woodruff and colleagues published in 2011 this study that got a lot of press, that made a lot of headlines, chemicals in U.S. pregnant women. And they did test for, I'm just going to refer to the exact numbers for you, 268 different industrial chemicals in 163 women. And you can see that they found some level of all of those different chemicals within the sample of women that they tested. And the different categories, I'm hoping it shows up pretty well on the slide. I think that it does. Again, once again, we see the same types of categories as the Environmental Working Group study, lots of pesticides, PFCs, flame retardants, and heavy metals. So this is a cause for great concern because these are the chemicals that our pregnant women and therefore their children are being exposed to. And then the next example is a European birth cohort, which again found flame retardants, PFCs, BPA, which is an endocrine disruptor. One of the things that was interesting about this study is the levels of flame retardants were lower than the levels of flame retardants found in the U.S. population, and the belief is that that is because the regulations in the European Union are quite different than the regulations that we have here in the United States, that there are more flame retardants banned in the European Union than there are here in the U.S. So, all of this to say that there are many, many, many different chemicals that pregnant women and their offspring are exposed to. This was a chart that I made up for last year's APHA presentation, and it was in that situation I did a literature review of the last decade of infant cord blood studies, and in fact, all of them showed many different chemicals, many of the same ones that I've already listed. So, what are the implications of all of this prenatal exposure? Well, as Ted pointed out, there are lifelong consequences from early life exposures. And I think one of the most fascinating concepts to consider is what's now entitled the developmental origins of health and disease. And the basic premise here is that what the child is exposed to in utero not only affects birth outcome, not only affects risk of childhood diseases, which are increasing over the last few decades, but in fact can program the tissues in that child's body to be more susceptible to disease later in life. So this builds, as I have noted on the slide, builds upon the work of David Barker, who looked at historic data where there was a cohort of children who were exposed to severe malnutrition, and then later in life, in their 40s and 50s, they were much, much more susceptible to heart disease. And the theory there is that the brain and the developing nervous system grow and get energy and are developing at a preferential rate. So if there's limited resources for that developing fetus, the brain is going to get the most nutrition and the rest of the tissues are left lacking. They are therefore going to be somewhat weaker and more susceptible to disease later in life. And as Ted had mentioned, this leads to lends credence to the theory of epigenetic programming in utero. And the belief is that some of these chronic, long-term diseases that public health is trying to deal with, like asthma, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, are things that we could really trace backwards to the very beginnings of life. So this is, once again, a very similar slide to others that you cited, the same lovely graphic, and just to re-illustrate the point. This is an illustration of the epigenetic principles, excuse me, and the concept that that there can be an effect across generations, that stress, chemicals that affect the developing fetus are also affecting the germinal cells, at least if it's a female fetus, but also the reproductive organs of the male as that male fetus is developing, and then those changes can be passed along to that, you know, once that child becomes an adult, to their offspring. So, what does this mean for clinical practice? Once again, because of limited time, I'm just going to go rather quickly through these slides. So I will let you know that there are tools for health screening, and also many different materials to provide guidance to patients, and there are lots and lots of online resources for training if you are interested and if you want to share that with colleagues. I'm going to just show you some pictures, and I have some of the materials available in the back. This is a screening tool that the patient can fill out on their own, and there's some guidance on how to avoid risk factors during pregnancy. This is another tool from Planned Parenthood. Once again, the UCSF Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment has some lovely brochures to give out. They also have webinars, a lot of information about food and making safer food choices to avoid exposure to chemicals that are part of our traditional, our conventional food supply. Specifically, there's some handouts on pesticides and other environmental contaminants from Planned Parenthood. I have a video in the back that I hope you will take, so I have 100 copies from the McGee's Women's Hospital. It is directly oriented to the patient, so it helps that patient to understand ways that they can reduce their risks. And there are also some classes that are given at this hospital. If any of you are interested in the curriculum of the classes, I can connect you with the people who have made those plans. PSR has an environmental toolkit that if you have not seen, you should definitely go to because it is really the prime example of patient education on reducing environmental risks. And then I will just let you know that these professional organizations also have a wide variety of online trainings, many of them with CME and CNE, so that people can get their training and receive their professional credit. So please do contact me if you have more questions, and I'm very happy to have had the opportunity to talk to you today.